Hey everybody, welcome to episode 21 of the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com. I'm your host, Brian Sippets. If you'd like to discuss today's episode, or any other episode for that matter, you can contact me at HockeyStrengthPodcast@gmail.com. Before we hook up with today's guest, we just want to talk a little bit about the Great Lakes Hockey Strength and Conditioning Clinic. We are wrapping up everything as we speak. The clinic was about 2 weeks ago. And from all accounts, it was a huge success. I think we had tons of great information for our participants and a nice range of opportunities to learn. So we learned about some fundamentals from Daryl Nelson. We also learned about some higher-level things from Justin Rothling-Sheffer from Miami University, Steve McGregor from Eastern Michigan University, and also Joe Marr about creating a yearly training plan at the University of Michigan. So. Really great information, I think, from all the reviews we've gotten. I think everybody really enjoyed the event, and that's definitely something we're already in the planning stages of for next year. So we hope that that's an event that's going to grow, and hope it's an event that can provide coaches, strength and conditioning professionals, anyone who works with hockey players with the best possible information about improving the performance of hockey players. So that was a huge success, and we're looking forward to planning next year. On today's episode, we're going to be doing something just a little bit different. We're not going to be talking as much about the training of your hockey athletes, but we're going to be talking a little bit more about the coaching side of things. I think the coaching is a lot of times overlooked as a critical skill. So we're going to be talking to Dr. Sion Bylock from the University of Chicago, who is also an author of two books called Choke and How the Body Knows Its Mind. And those two books have some really critical coaching knowledge and things that are very important for any of our coaches to understand and to know while they're coaching their athletes, so that we put our athletes in the best position possible to be successful. So we're looking forward to talking to Dr. Bylock, and in just a minute we'll get going with Dr. Sion Bylock. But in case you aren't familiar with HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com, we pride ourselves in being the greatest collection of hockey strength and conditioning information, complete with material from the top NHL, collegiate, and private strength coaches. At HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com, you'll find hundreds of articles, videos, programs, webinars, all geared towards improving the performance of hockey players. So it doesn't matter if you're a strength and conditioning coach, a motivated player, a youth coach, or even a hockey parent. HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com is the only training resource you'll ever need to produce healthier, stronger, and more effective players at any level. Every week, we're posting new articles, videos, and programs, and also periodic podcasts and webinars. And in addition to all that, our coaches weigh in on the ongoing forum discussions. So if you have a question or anything, you can address our coaches directly in the forum. If you're new to HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com, you can get instant access to our members-only content for just $1 for the first 7 days. You'll be able to check out all of our training videos, current programs, and articles, as well as information from the best strength coaches in hockey, or they can answer your questions directly in the forum. We're positive that you're going to love the content, but if you're not completely happy with it, simply cancel your trial membership, and you'll be out just $1. After the 7-day trial, you can continue to be a member for just $14.95 a month, or you can sign up for the year at just $149 and receive 2 months for free. Either option's a great bargain for so much material from the nation's top coaches, so don't miss your chance to be a part of the community. All right, well, we've been waiting for this opportunity for a long, long time. We're really excited to get going with our guest for today, Dr. Sion Bylock. All right, we're on the phone with professor of psychology at University of Chicago and also author of two great books called Choke and also How Your Body Knows Its Mind. We're on the phone with Dr. Sion Bylock at University of Chicago. Dr. Bylock, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. So we spent quite a bit of time here trying to get hooked up, and I'm really glad that you were able to talk to us. I know you're busy talking to executives and corporate retreats and coaches and all these people that can really benefit from your expertise. And so I think the biggest thing for our audience, you have
two books. The first one is called Choke, which I definitely recommend to anybody who coaches with us, all of our coaches. There's some really awesome information in there. Some of it's about the world of academia. The rest of it is really applies to coaching. And I think maybe the biggest take home for our coaches is this idea of paralysis by analysis. Could you maybe talk us through that situation and why it's important for us to know about that as coaches?
Sure. I think oftentimes when athletes are on the field and it's a really important moment when there's a lot of pressure associated with what they're doing, you often hear coaches and parents and even athletes themselves thinking, what I have to do at this moment is concentrate, you know, pay as much attention as I can to make sure I do everything right. And actually, the work that I've done and my colleagues have done and that I write about in my book, Choke, shows that actually that concentration in that moment when it's focused on the step-by-step details of what you're doing can actually be a bad thing. In the moment, you really want to go by this motto of just do it, the Nike motto, if you will. And the idea is that you've practiced to a high level, and by thinking too much about the details in the moment, you actually disrupt what you're doing.
So by drawing attention to the actual operation itself, or the actual, I guess, coordination of the movement, you can really kind of throw things off. And we've heard this idea before. Can you talk a little bit about, how we have this, you call it a strategy focus rather than a technique focus? Why is that important?
Yeah, the idea is that it's as if you were shuffling down the stairs and I asked you to think about what you were doing with your knee as you ran down the stairs. You don't think about everything. Not everything comes into conscious awareness. That's why we can do such amazing coordinated acts at once. We can only focus on so many things. And if I asked you to focus on your knee, there's a good chance you'd fall on your face. It's not something you usually pay attention to. To do that, you'd have to slow down and disrupt everything you're doing. And so the idea is that in these high-stakes situations, in order to ensure an optimal outcome, that the ball is hit in the right place, that basket is made, the goal is scored, oftentimes athletes start thinking about all those details, and it essentially mucks up their ability to execute what they've practiced. And so instead of focusing on those details, there's actually techniques that I talk about in Choke and in my new book, How the Body Knows Its Mind, that we can use to ensure that we're focusing on what's optimal in these stressful situations. So in golf, for example, we talk about focusing on one swing thought, one thought that encapsulates the entire putting stroke, that allows you to take your mind off of those step-by-step details and focus on something at a high level. When you're trying to make that perfect shot, focusing on the outcome, where you want the ball to land, anything that prevents you from going in and unpacking all of those aspects of what you do that are normally on autopilot. And of course, this is also a great way to screw up your buddy on the back nine. You know, when they hit a shot, you say, that was great. I'm just wondering what you were doing with your elbow.
Yeah, so a little psychological warfare there. And I've, based on your work, I've talked about that too, where really the more you start breaking down something that's automatic, the more screwed up your movement will end up being. So what are some good habits for coaches to get into? So we teach a lot of big movements. So if we're teaching, let's say something like a power clean or some really complex movement, is there a way that we could instruct that would keep us from getting into that situation where we're telling them individual body parts?
I think, you know, there's a time to focus on the details when you're just learning something for the first time. But we also know that learning by analogy, that talking about the outcome, how you want the movement to be rather than every step, kids are pretty good at figuring out how to get there. And so this idea that you just have to go down to the minutiae, the specific detail may not actually be true. Demonstrating it accurately, kids can learn from that. And then you, of course, want to practice in conditions, once you've taught whatever details you need to get out there, practice in conditions where you're mimicking some of the stress, where they are getting used to what it's going to be like when all eyes are on them, and also where they're practicing not paying attention to those details.
Yeah, and you mentioned why demonstration is such an effective teaching tool. And that's something that, you know, we gets into a lot more and a lot more depth in your second book, How the Body Knows Its Mind. Can you tell us a little bit why that's such an effective technique is just, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, we hear a lot about mirror neurons and how that could possibly be a reason that people are able to mimic each other in certain situations. But I guess that's kind of cooled off now. But what's the mechanism behind that? Why is demonstration such a great teaching tool?
Well, I think the idea behind mirror neurons and this notion that the way we understand others is by simulating what's happening in our own heads as if we were doing it is still very much alive. And the idea is that when you watch someone else, especially if they're, you know, just slightly better than you, you're actually able to understand what they're doing partly by mimicking in your own head how you would do the same thing. And it's a type of covert practice, much like mental imagery. And so demonstrating can be a great way for students or for athletes to start to pick up some of the techniques that you're trying to teach.
And how far does that take you? I mean, is that going to be effective? Obviously, there's going to be kind of a big learning curve at the beginning. Like, it might have a giant effect in the beginning, and then does that tend to taper off, or is it always going to pay off for an athlete to see that great technique or great demonstration?
It's an interesting question about the bang you get for your buck, so to speak, later on. I think it's certainly better to see demonstrations of good performance than bad. And anything we can do to help provide input about correct technique and information is generally probably a good thing.
Right. So as we're coaching these things and we're showing movement, we're demonstrating movement. Let's talk about this idea of feedback. How often is feedback beneficial? I mean, are we getting into something where we're over coaching? You know, it's going to be a feel, obviously, as a coach to know when somebody's like losing ground rather than gaining ground. But in the area of feedback, how much feedback should we really be offering our athletes?
I mean, I think that's, you know, there's lots of individualized technique here, as you know, as a coach. We do know, though, that the same constant feedback over and over certainly starts losing its impact. The extent to which you can provide varied feedback or actually alternate the time between you when you provide feedback can be a good thing. Anything that gets the athlete to experiment on their own in a way that can allow them to find the optimal outcome can be a good thing.
Yeah, so it's much more based on feel. I think, you know, there's this art of coaching, and really the art of coaching is using the tools that we know about to get an optimal outcome, like you said. So it is going to be a little bit of an individual thing, but, you know, I don't know. I didn't know if there was some kind of secret you'd be able to let us in on.
But I also think, you know, you talk about this art of coaching, it's also using the tools that you know and knowing when to lay off in a way and let the athlete explore on their own. I mean, something that we talk about in learning all sorts of skills is this notion of what is often talked about as a desirable difficulty. There's got to be one of the ways to commit information to memory and to learn to do a particular moment is to have some sort of challenge that gets you into what you're doing. If you don't have to think at all about what you're doing, it's likely you're not going to remember it later.
Right. So maybe a little bit of failure, a little bit of struggle can be beneficial in the learning process.
Certainly, in order to get better and to push yourself to that next level, just doing what you know over and over again is, I think, it's pretty well documented that's not the way to get there.
Gotcha. You know, one more thing I wanted to touch on here is, and this is something that I had the opportunity to help you out with at Miami and really kind of, I guess, kick off my interest in all of this, just the idea of experts versus novices. And so as coaches, we're going to have people who are new to movements. We're going to have people that we've had for years, maybe even in the same group. And so how can we cater our instruction to make sure that we're improving both groups at the same time? Even say you're in a group setting, a lot of us work in team settings. How can we use strategies that are going to help improve both groups at the same time, both experts and novices?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, one thing that we found in our research that I talk about in my book, Choke, is that sometimes the best players or the most expert individuals don't always know how to demonstrate something to a novice just because it's hard for them to put themselves in their shoes. It's hard to remember how you thought about it when you were just learning something. And so even having capitalizing on your variation in your group, having people that are more skilled and maybe even not the best, but more skilled sort of work with people who are less skilled can help be an interesting way for them to demonstrate what they know. It can also put those more skilled individuals in somewhat of a pressure situation, which gets them used to what it's going to be like when all eyes are on you. So I would say, like, thinking about ways in which you can use your better players to help them be themselves coach the less skilled players could be an interesting way to approach this.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It hadn't occurred to me that idea of you know, the curse of knowledge. And how maybe having the more skilled guys coach or instruct the younger guys. Plus, that's just a great team environment. I mean, you're also teaching leadership. You're offering chances for leadership. So yeah, that would actually be an excellent way to do that. I think I'll start doing that. Actually, that's a nice idea.
And you're also offering those more skilled individuals a chance to perform while others are watching them, which we know is a hallmark of stressful situations. So in a way, you're actually helping them practice for those situations when everyone's watching.
Absolutely. Yeah, I like that a lot. Now, most of your research, I guess the early research, was done with golf and putting greens. You actually set up a putting green in your lab. Could you tell us a little bit about those studies? Those are kind of a while ago and sort of the cornerstone of what you've been working on up till now, but I think it's really interesting and it's a great way to illustrate kind of the things that we've talked about. Can you talk about those studies a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, we have, as part of our laboratory, I run the Human Performance Laboratory at the University of Chicago, and as part of my laboratory, we actually have a putting green where we bring in highly skilled golfers and try and get them to choke under pressure. And the idea is that if we can understand what happens in the brain and body when people choke, we can start developing tools to help people. And this is true in athletics, but we also do work in negotiation settings or giving public speaking, giving talks, or when students are taking tests. And the idea is to really understand what's going on. And we also use neuroimaging techniques. We use fMRI to actually peek under the hood, so to speak, to look at what's happening in the brain when people are succeeding or failing, so we can try and, again, help train the psychological aspects of the game, just like we might train a muscle or our endurance.
So, right, so this is kind of where you've sort of, I guess, documented the idea of calling attention to a movement effect rather than the coordination of the movement itself. So maybe hit the ball towards the hole rather than, you know, move your hands through the ball or something like that. And that's
what you're doing with your wrist, for example.
Right. And that's kind of where we get to this idea. And I think Gabrielle Wolf has done a lot of this too, where you talk about calling attention to external things. So rather than referencing the body, maybe tie your instructions to the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been really kind of a game changer for me too. And you start thinking about your facility or your space as a coach in really different terms. So now I have four different walls in my facility that I refer to if we're doing some kind of movement. So have something that distinguishes the walls in the facility rather than just saying, you know, butt back or, you know, arms up or wrist bent or something like that.
Right. So you can talk about the yellow wall or the blue wall.
Right. All right. Well, that's all really great information, Dr. Bialek. Thanks so much for taking some time to join us. And you know, I know you're super busy, and I would like to know, or let everybody know, kind of where they can purchase your books, because they are, like I said, this is required reading for our coaches, and you know, I think would be really, really beneficial for anybody who's coaching athletes or anybody who's managing, even people who manage people at work. So where can we get both Choke and How Your Body Knows It's Mine?
Both books, Choke and How the Body Knows It's Mine, are on Amazon or on my book website, which is my name, Sian, Sian, VEILOCK, beyondbylock.com.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us. I think this is really great, valuable knowledge for coaches and can really help us become better at what we do. And I know you're busy, so we'll let you go. But thanks again so much for joining us. And we look forward to hearing more from you, maybe a couple books in the future. Who knows?
No problem.
All right.
Bye, Brian.
Thanks, Kevin.
No problem.
All right. That's going to do it for episode 21 of the Hockey Strength Podcast. We'd like to thank our special guest, Dr. Sion Bylock from the University of Chicago. Really great talking to her and learning a little bit more about how we can put our athletes in the best position to succeed, especially under pressure. This is Brian Sipitz for the Hockey Strength Podcast. Check back with us in a couple weeks for the next episode. Until then, be sure to train smart and check out HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com for the web's greatest articles, videos, and programs for training hockey players. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you soon.